welcome.
Oh, you were going to do it. Honestly, this is such a terrible way to get going. I will not. I'm not going to rain on your parade. Take it away, my friends.
I didn't have an intro, but man, talk about getting off to a great start. You know, a couple of minutes ago, we were just talking about how crazy our days have been and that we don't have a great outline. And here we go, right from the jump. So I'll kick it off. Welcome, as always, to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One. Joining you, as always, is Mr. Mark Daly, Mr. Mark Hamilton. We are settling in 4 or 5 days out from a very eventful British Grand Prix. And it's so funny. The overwhelming feedback that I had from so many of our listeners and our community this week was, I'm done with Silverstone. I'm done with that racing incident. I'm ready to move on. And it's really interesting because, and I didn't talk about this on the podcast last Sunday, but I carried a degree of anxiety into that show that I've never had before. Like, honestly, when we're getting ready for a podcast, I'm excited. Maybe I don't feel like I'm totally prepared. My notes aren't dialed in, but I've never had anxiety. And it was really because the racing incident happened, didn't feel good about it. And then the entire day, I just kept consuming more and more and more social media. And the social media was so divisive and so violent in so many different ways. And of course, there was a fallout all week and it wasn't ideal. So one of the commitments that we had tonight was when we were doing our Spaces chat, guys, we're moving on so many other topics. And then you share the outline for the podcast tonight. And again, I get it. There's just so much to unpack still 4 or 5 days later. But what a week, what a race. The championship is completely up in the air once again, both the drivers and the constructors. We've been cautioning people about this for weeks. It was never a write-off. Mr. Max Verstappen was never going to run away with it. But here we are, my friend. All of that said,
I'm good. You know, I'm looking forward to getting this show going here today, kicking things off. It's been one of those crazy days. Like, since I got up this morning, just after 6 a.m., I've been running nonstop, and I'm just happy to finally take a load off, sit down, sit here and talk about Formula One for the next hour, hour and a half, or whatever it is. And it's so funny because I didn't get a chance to drop into the Spaces session a little bit earlier on. And so I completely missed out this moratorium on that incident. So, you know, to everybody that was on Twitter tonight, my apologies, because, you know, I'm a glasses half full guy. I always have been. I tend to be ridiculously optimistic, probably even when I shouldn't be. But I've looked at this thing that even though, yes, it's become a little bit, I wouldn't say annoying, but it's certainly had its run its mileage, let's put it that way. But I've also seen it as the gift that kind of keeps on giving, because it really is one of those flashpoints in the season, and we really haven't seen a situation like this before. Well, we have, but not in a good many years, and certainly not between two rival drivers and two different teams. I mean, we can go back to half a dozen incidents between Nico Rosberg and Lewis Hamilton when they were partnered together at Mercedes. But the only two, well, I mean, there's several incidents. I mean, you can go back to Senna and Prost at Japan in 1988. You can go to Damon Hill and Michael Schumacher in Australia in, what was that, 1994. And then JV and Michael Schumacher at Estoril in 97. So, I mean, these things have happened, but just not very often. So I apologize to the select few that came out tonight for this, excuse me, the Spaces session.
And no apologies necessary. And you framed it perfectly, right? Like, this is the type of fodder that sports radio lives for, which is this topic that you can continue to unpack and unwind for days and days, especially when we're 2 weeks between Grand Prix. But you're absolutely right. I think the one thing that really surprised me was just, it was how visceral the debate became. And like I said, I didn't feel great going into the podcast last Saturday simply because I'd never seen anything quite like this. And it shouldn't have come as a surprise that contact finally happened. We all knew this was going to be happening. We've been talking about it in the Spaces chats. We've been talking about it on Twitter. You and I have been talking about it on the show for months now, that if you have two very, very competitive drivers that are battling for a championship, this is eventually going to come. This is just the outcome of racing. I think what was surprising was ultimately the knock-on downstream effects of that contact, which we're going to get into tonight. And I think we'll take it in a pretty moderate, level-headed kind of way. We're not going to get super combative or I would say violent ourselves in terms of our rhetoric, but definitely some stuff here that we probably want to unpack. One other comment I'll make real quick, mm-hmm. just because I am a super Drake nerd. Drake dropped a new track about 36 minutes ago. Thank you to my good friend Parsa for dropping me a line reminding me of that. So
sweet.
If you are a hip-hop fan, if you are a music fan, there's some new Drake out there to keep you going until he finally drops Certified Lover Boy, which...
It'll happen. Just like, I think that's a great comparison because we know it's going to happen, just like we knew that something was going to happen between Lewis and Max Verstappen. I mean, we saw it in Bahrain, we saw it in Imola, and then we've seen some races where one or the other had a slight advantage over the other. So it was bound to happen in a 20 something odd race season. I mean, the final tally right. is still to be determined, of course, that something like this was going to be, it was just going to happen because there have been times where they're really close. And I mean, the way that Lewis was all over the back of him, it was just something that was going to happen. I mean, Mercedes trackside engineering director Andrew Shovlin, he basically said the same thing as well, that it was inevitable, which I think it basically echoes everything that everybody's talked about and realized themselves. But just kind of going back to more of the fallout, and this is why I keep saying this is the gift that really keeps giving here, is that it was interesting that Instagram post that Max made on Sunday night after the Grand Prix was over, he was still in hospital, he was still getting checked out, and he was saying on Instagram and Twitter, wherever he posted this, that he thought that Lewis's post-race celebrations were disrespectful, but he wasn't going to dwell on it, and he decided he was going to move on. But Mercedes has said that they've only come out and celebrated because they had been told by FIA and by Red Bull that Max was okay, he was uninjured, he was just in hospital getting checked out. And sure, I can understand in the heat of the moment why everybody would get upset and maybe tensions would still be high, but I don't know why you would do otherwise.
Yeah, I very much agree with you. And let's be totally honest. One, it was very clear that Hamilton was concerned about mm-hmm. Max after the contact. We heard it on the radio. We tweeted about it. The first thing he asked is Max okay? He gets the all clear that he's out of the car. And obviously, he was shooken up, possibly had a concussion. He wasn't looking great, but he was out of the car. He was standing under his own power. That was good that was the first thing that Lewis asked. And obviously, it should be. It always mm-hmm. would be. But as a racing driver, the minute he understands that his competitor's healthy, he's out of the car, he's dialed back in. He has to be dialed back in because he's got how many places that he needs mm-hmm. to make up to get back into this race. And ultimately, I also, the more time passes, the less I believe that Hamilton's celebration was disrespectful. Look, he drove a lap of the circuit with a Union Jack. Again, this is his home race in front of his home fans. He didn't see them last year because of COVID. This is the first major sporting event in the UK that's been hosted in front of fans. You have 140,000 people there in 30 plus degrees Celsius weather, which is might as well be 50 degree Celsius weather for the rest of the world because the Brits aren't necessarily used to this type of heat. He does a lap with the flag. He comes into Parc Fermé. He jumps over the wall, waves the flag. The photographers surround him, and he goes in front of the crowd and celebrates with the trophy. I don't think it was disrespectful. In fact, he understood, and to your point, the Merck team understood, the Mercedes team understood that, hey, he's good. He's been checked out. They reported to the FIA. They reported to Massey. They reported to the stewards. Mercedes knew. I don't think it was disrespectful. And I don't want to be that guy that says, hey, go and look at Max in Bahrain last year. But there's instances where maybe Max wasn't necessarily so cautious and conservative in his approach to a celebration. But ultimately, I think that the emotions were running high. Max was shook up. He was frustrated. He was angry. He was seeing his championship lead dwindle in front of his eyes. He was seeing the race unfold while he's at the hospital. He's in a particularly emotional state, which I totally get. I just, 2, 3, 4, 5 days later, I just don't see that this Mercedes celebration of Lewis Hamilton was even remotely disrespectful.
Yeah, it's interesting too. I mean, I know this is a pure speculation, but had this been at the Dutch Grand Prix at Zandvoort, and which is going to be the first race there and since 1984, whether if the situation was completely flipped on its head, what Max would have done otherwise. But anyways, a little bit of context. Mercedes team principal Toto Wolff said, quote, "It's important to understand all the feedback we received. We had the feedback from senior management of Red Bull that Max was fine. Christian Horner mentioned it to Michael Massey, who's the FIA race director, on the intercom that he's unharmed and fine, and the FIA gave us similar feedback. So at no point would we have celebrated if Max would have been injured, and I think that is very important to understand." Perfect. So we can move on from that. So this I find kind of interesting because Toto keeps he keeps talking about this, and why wouldn't he? But he said that he's uneasy about the scale of what he called Red Bull's personal attacks after the incident at the British Grand Prix. And he says that he actually hopes that they can, restore a professional rivalry between the two teams. Anyways, he was talking to motorsport.com, and Toto had to say, quote, "I think you can understand that from a competitor's point of view, the situation was upsetting. I can understand that. Nevertheless, the language that was used and making it so personal was a level that we have not seen in this sport before." End quote. Yeah, I mean, it got really, really heated. I mean, let's put it that way.
Yeah. I was actually somebody that was... I actually defended, and I'm trying to choose my words carefully here because I want to make sure that I articulate this correctly. Obviously, I think folks that listen to this call know that I've questioned Christian Horner's execution and his role in directing this team. Yeah. I've been a big critic of Helmut Marko. But, you know, I flash back to Sunday, and in the heat of the moment, I said I kind of got where he was coming from, especially the comments that emanated out of that wall, out of that paddock, out of that garage during the race itself. I get it. You know, you're in a situation where your key lead driver, that doesn't even matter. One of your drivers is in an incident where he's clearly shaken up, possibly as a concussion, he's taken to the hospital. It's the heat of the moment. You're emotional. You're frustrated. You're concerned. Yeah. You're talking about the championship. You're talking about the fact that this car might be a write-off. Can we even salvage the power unit? There's a lot of stuff going through your head. I think, though, that in hindsight, maybe I was even a little bit too generous in my defense of Horner. And part of the reason I say that is, as a professional, as an executive in the sport, your words carry much, much, much more weight than an analyst, a former driver, somebody that's sitting in the crowd, somebody tweeting at home. You are a team principal representing that organization, and your words carry weight. And I don't want to, for a second, suggest that it's Horner's fault that we saw that outpouring of racism through social media. But when you make comments like that, and when Helmut Marko comes on and they make comments like he's reckless and he's got a unique, specific driving style, inferring that it's a dangerous driving style, these types of comments aren't helpful. And I think it does to a degree help fuel some of these folks that jump on the train, but take it kind of in this really inappropriate, disgusting racist bent. But I just think Christian Horner, it's not his fault that that crowd came out. But I think sometimes when you initiate the conversation using such decisive language, divisive language, like he was reckless driving and specific type of style, inferring that it's dangerous. And then even the comments from Helmut Marko a few weeks ago suggesting that Alex Albon's career was ruined by Lewis Hamilton, you're constantly building this narrative and this upswell of negative sentiment towards Hamilton. And then unfortunately, there's always going to be this segment of the population that may not even be Formula One fans, but they can grab onto that and use that as fuel for really negative, unproductive rhetoric that was unfortunately directed at Lewis both that day and throughout the course of the week. And one of the things I'd seen as well is there's this, and again, it may not be significant, but this movement within the fans that are going to be attending at Zandvoort that, hey, you know, we should be bringing tomatoes and throwing tomatoes at Lewis and all this really negative, really unfortunate rhetoric that I don't historically associate with Formula One. And I just think for Christian Horner, you have to understand, and to Helmut Marko as well, that your words carry weight. And it's one thing for a TV analyst to say, hey, you know, Mazepin's a reckless driver. You know what? I get it. It's an analyst. But when you're an executive of a team talking about a 7-time world champion who has never, never, never been criticized for dangerous, reckless driving, that's pretty unproductive territory to be walking into with these types of comments, regardless of how emotional you are.
Yeah, I mean, Toto even addressed it. He's kind of drawn a line underneath it now. He said, quote, "I think once the emotions are down, we will try to restore our professional relationship for the sake of Formula One. But beyond that, there were no discussions and don't need to be," end quote. So I really don't know what to add to that. I mean, the outbursts and just the way that all the negative stuff came out afterwards, I think was obviously... it was uncalled for and obviously very unfortunate that it happened. And I seriously hope that they can restore some kind of a professional, like he says, a professional relationship between the two, because that's what the sport needs. They need a good, healthy rivalry that everybody's going to get pumped up and get jacked up about every time that these cars get out on the track.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And this is maybe why I didn't feel so great last Saturday, because to me, it's still a racing incident, assigned a little bit of fault here, a little bit of fault there. I don't object to the penalty that Hamilton was awarded. What I didn't like was the vitriol that came pouring out of both camps and social media after. I didn't feel good about that. Like I said, I didn't feel good coming into the podcast. Racing's supposed to be fun. Sport is supposed to be fun. And I didn't like the direction it was taken. And to your point, you look at these comments from Horner, I get it, heat of the moment, you're emotional, you're concerned about your driver, you're concerned about the championship, but sometimes specific words can be unproductive. And furthermore, let me be clear, I'm not blaming for a second, the Red Bull camp or Horner for some of the racist commentary that came out of social media. It just, when you have high-level executives like this, you know what, attacking Hamilton in the way he was, it doesn't help. It helps to open up that gateway for those type of comments and to make it okay and to normalize that kind of attack.
Yeah, unfortunately, you're right. Anyhow, let's take a quick break here on the show. We'll come back and then we'll talk about, well, a couple more things sort of related to what we are talking about, and then hopefully something completely new. Anyways, we'll do that in just a moment, so don't go away. We'll be right back in just a moment. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Okay, everybody, welcome back to the show. Mark and Mark, Daly and Hamilton here on a very busy Thursday night. I was going to say January. Gosh, you know, it feels like it could be January the way that the year has been going, not by the weather, just by the pace and the snowballing effect of the year. Anyways, it is July 22nd, 2021. It is the middle of the summer in the Northern Hemisphere. The weather has been glorious here on the west coast of British Columbia.
It has.
It has. I mean, after that insane heat dome almost a month ago, 3.5 weeks ago, the weather's been actually pretty glorious. I mean, we could do a with a little bit of rain, which seems ironic and counterintuitive to come from the mouth of a person that lives in a city that gets about 275 days of rain a year or something like that. But anyways, the weather.
275?
I know. I'm being...
It's a lot higher than that. It feels like that. And I saw a story today, and I don't know that this is necessarily true, but I saw a story that it's been 37 days since we've had rain throughout the BC Lower Mainland, which is apparently a record, but it feels like it's been a while since we've had a wash of rain in our neighborhood.
It does feel parched out there. There are a couple of things I just want to sort of tidy up when we, you know, to go on or before we can move on about this, because there's a couple more comments I want to talk about. And this whole thing about like team principals lobbying the stewards during the, in real time during the race and stuff like that.
Totally.
Excuse me. I'm getting so excited. I'm choking on my words here. Anyways, Toto Wolff, the Mercedes team principal, he stepped up. He's backed his driver. He's backed his guy. And he said that Lewis Hamilton is the opposite of a dirty F1 driver, which I think echoes what we've been saying. And again, we're not trying to come off as Hamilton apologists, but I think you just have to take a look objectively at the body of work that Lewis Hamilton has done in Formula One during his career. And I don't really think that there's any other way that you can look at this. I think that he tried to race Max hard. I think he missed the apex of the corner. I think he went in too fast, and maybe it was a little bit misguided. And well, hey, it was racing, and sometimes these things happen in racing. And yeah, it was unfortunate for Max. It was unfortunate for Red Bull. I mean, it flipped the championship on its head, but at the end of the day, you know, I went back because I think I said on the show on Sunday night that I immediately messaged you when I was watching the race that, oh, I'm putting that 100% on Lewis. But over the course of time, as I settled down and the adrenaline kind of, you know, boiled away a little bit, and I looked at it objectively, I realized that it was a little bit more nuanced than that. I mean, certainly he takes the proportion of the blame going into that, but yeah, I just don't know how you can disagree or even take that stance that Lewis Hamilton is a dirty driver. It does not compute.
Yeah, completely agree. And I think obviously people and folks that have been listening to this show for a while probably recognize that I'm a Lewis fan. I'm happy to see him win. But at the same time, I've been crystal clear this entire championship that ultimately I don't care who wins as long as it's competitive, as long as it's fun, as long as it's close. I would rather see Max Verstappen win in the last race of the season than to see Lewis win with three or four races yep. left. That's not good for the championship. Seeing it go down to the wire and seeing somebody like Max Verstappen win, that's good. It's good for the sport. It's compelling from a broadcast perspective. It gives us, selfishly, it gives us a lot to talk about. But I agree. I just think this was a mistake. I think he was a little fast, miscalculated potentially the toe he had. And I think ultimately he made some contact with Max Verstappen. But at the same time, you could also argue that Max maybe didn't give him enough space, et cetera, et cetera. I think at the end of the day, what is crystal clear or should be crystal clear to anybody that knows Formula One is that that was not a calculated move by Hamilton. He did not go into that corner with the expectation or the objective of making contact with Max. He's not about to throw away his own race because making contact could be hyper unpredictable. Mm-hmm. You could make contact and end up with a puncture while Max gets away unscathed. You could make contact and have significant aero damage that requires you to retire when Max maybe gets a puncture but still finishes the race and scores points. There's no way Hamilton in any galaxy, in any alternative universe, is going to go into that corner with the intention of making contact. I think he went hot, maybe it misanticipated the toe. Whatever the case, I don't think it was intentional. The one thing I would also add as well is that as time has gone by over the course of this week, we've had more and more and more former drivers chime in on this. And overwhelmingly now, the sentiment seems to be, at least from a former F1 driver perspective, this is a racing incident. It was a racing incident. It wasn't dirty. It was a mistake. Hamilton got a penalty. It was one step away from being a much more severe penalty. And maybe we can debate the severity of the penalty. Should it have been a stop-go penalty, a five-second penalty, a 10-second penalty? Seems to be fair. That said, Hamilton served the penalty. He didn't complain, and he fought back, and he won the race. So you can't complain. But I kind of get it from a Red Bull fan perspective. You know what? We're in a close championship. You see Hamilton chip away at it by 25 points, but I just can't believe that anyone who knows the sport or has been watching it for a while could honestly believe that was a calculated move by
Hamilton. I mean, Danny Ricciardo, I mean, he basically said in as many words that Hamilton went too hot into that corner, into Cosps, and went before he hit Max. But yeah, I mean, doing that on purpose, I mean, the risks really outweigh the returns, because this is, you know, absolutely, especially with these cars, that if you sneeze at them the wrong way, something's going to break off the bodywork.
Absolutely.
Anyways, 2 points on that, and then I want to move ahead. Number one, the people that have been getting in touch with us over the past, you know, 2-3 races or whatever, since Max has been opening up that gap, and I don't want to say that they've maybe tuned out, but there was definitely a little bit of concern that maybe he might start to walk away with that championship. I hope that maybe that this has reinvigorated, maybe reengaged some of these people that maybe were starting to wonder if this might be over in a couple of races. So that has definitely hit that reset button. And then also, if we've gotten a show and a half of material out of this now, I'm just wondering what the hell are the DTS guys going to do when season 4 comes out next spring?
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. So I actually made notes of that. I can't believe I didn't bring this up. This last race was absolute fodder for Drive to Survive. The whole Netflix crew, the Box, because I believe it's produced by Box to Box Films.
That's right.
They must just be salivating at the storylines that they can unwind by this. And I don't know how much crew they had there. I'm sure it was pretty significant, regardless, just because of the fact that it's Lewis's homecoming. He hasn't raced in front of his home crowd in 2 years. We knew there was going to be 140,000 fans there. So either way, it was going to be a compelling storyline for an episode of Drive to Survive. But you can start in your head piecing together what they could be assembling for season 4, but absolutely. And I can't even imagine how much footage we're going to see from the Horner camp, from the Wolf camp next February that we weren't privy to this year? Because that was one of the things that was so exciting about season three was, holy moly, I had no idea that conversation happened. I had no idea they felt this way about this scenario. I cannot wait to see how this plays out in Drive to Survive season four. That's a great call.
Yeah, it's awesome. And you know, some of the thing that was really, really cool is a lot of like the fan media that got posted. You know, you talked about it, that one video that somebody who was sitting like 2-3 rows up at Cop's Corner there, just a little bit over from where Max hit the barrier, the tires there. I mean, that was crazy. I watched that video probably at least 10 times, and every time I was absolutely astonished by the just the violence of that impact. So yeah.
And shout out to Charlie for tweeting that one to our main Twitter account, because I hadn't seen that.
Yep.
Same. I must have watched it 3 or 4 times. And it's this crazy moment where you have this brief split second where Hamilton and Verstappen are coming into the corner. The crowd begins to erupt because they see that there's a potential overtake happening. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, Max is just sliding towards them at an unbelievable rate. And you can hear the gasp in the crowd. And it's like the energy and the oxygen is just sucked out of the crowd. And then after he makes contact, people are looking at each other and they're looking at their bodies to see if everyone's unscathed. Because as he came in, he threw up a ton of dirt and gravel.
It was like shrapnel almost flying through the air.
Exactly.
You know, not trying to be a little bit too facetious or condescending here, but it kind of makes you wonder if they are going to get a ton of fodder out of this race for season four of DTS. Makes you wonder if Max Verstappen's want to maybe get off the fence and get involved with, you know, this show or for season four, because, you know, he is basically the only driver that does not participate in Drive to Survive at the moment.
What a great point. And that's not something I'd considered. So for those of you at home that are maybe wondering why you didn't see a lot of Max in season one, season two, season three, it's because he's opted to sit out. He doesn't participate. But ultimately, this could be problematic in terms of shaping the narrative for season four, which is obviously the Mercedes team, Toto, Lewis, are actively involved in interviews and sharing footage and just generally being involved and engaging with the process of Drive to Survive. Max has made the decision not to. Christian Horner is clearly involved.
Oh, yeah, he's very into it.
he loves it, man. But in terms of shaping the storyline and the narrative, if you're giving access to Lewis and to Toto and they're sharing their comments and their feedback and their thoughts and being interviewed, and Max opts to sit out, it changes the narrative. So it'll also be interesting to see how Box2Box Films and Netflix are able to share the story and share this journey next season if Max doesn't participate, because you're really talking about somebody that's operating in isolation. Whereas when you're talking about Lewis, he's sitting in front of you addressing those questions on camera.
You know, I think that they did a really good job back in 2018 when they came out with season one, because the two protagonists that year were Ferrari and Mercedes, and neither of those teams took part. So any footage you saw of Lewis Hamilton, Sebastian Vettel, Valtteri Bottas, or Kimi Raikkonen, or anybody involved with those teams was just a stock footage, and they kind of spliced it in here or there. But I think they did a remarkable job to kind of work around that. But it was pretty obvious.
Totally.
But it really did add something for seasons two and three, that you had the full cooperation of Mercedes, full cooperation of Ferrari. But then again, as now Formula One has kind of evolved and Ferrari's kind of dropped off a little bit and Red Bull's been on the ascendancy in the last season and a bit, and now they're the main contender, the main rival to Mercedes, it is a bit interesting that, you know, Max is consciously going out of his way not to participate. So, yeah, it makes you wonder if he'll want to get involved. Anyway, so kind of moving away from the incident itself, but maybe to some of the sidebar ancillary issues that are going around. And so one comment that came out from Christian Horner says that he thinks it's unacceptable that the Formula One stewards can be lobbied by competitors in real time while they're reviewing a situation and coming to making their conclusions and ultimately a decision and a penalty, whatever the case may be. And he was very angry and upset the way that Toto Wolff was able to speak to the stewards while they were deliberating what to do regarding that incident between the crash between Lewis and Max Verstappen last weekend. And then Wolff was actually advised over the team radio by Michael Massey, the F1 race director, to go and actually speak to the stewards. So Horner actually got off his butt, got off the pit wall, went down to the steward's office himself to make sure that Red Bull's interest, his views, and their perspective was not ignored. So anyways, Horner had to say the following, quote, "I saw Toto, who was lobbying the stewards, and I heard he was going there to do it, so I went to make sure that our view was represented.
Yep.
I don't think that it's right that team principals should be able to go and lobby the stewards. That should be locked away, or they should be locked away so that they are not influenced. For me, it was unacceptable that he had gone up to lobby the stewards. I wanted to make sure that there was a balanced opinion given rather than trying to influence pressure on the stewards to make a menial sentence," end quote. And again, I mean, not taking Christian's or Red Bull's side specifically, but just from, you know, an objective point of view, then I guess I'm kind of taking his side because I'm going to agree with him. But I mean, you shouldn't be able in any sport to be able to lobby the officials. I mean, should you, like, as a basketball player in the NBA, be able to lobby the referee because you don't agree with a foul? Or, you know, in the NFL, did he have was he inbounds or out of bounds when he caught that pass? Did he cross the plane of the goal line? You know, whatever the case may be. Soccer, was that a penalty? Was that, you know, whatever the case may be. It's hard enough for the men and women that are charged to officiate these sports at any level, but especially the, you know, the higher the level it gets and the faster and the quicker and everything that it moves and the stakes and the money and everything, the prestige that becomes involved, it just becomes a little bit odious if people from one side or another, and I'm not going to really put Toto on blast. I mean, Horner's already done that. He did what I think was the right thing to do. If you're Red Bull, I mean, if you see your rival down there, you know, get out there, get in the room as well and make your voice heard. But, you know, I think he has a very, very valid point here.
I completely agree. I actually totally agree with Christian Horner in this case, which is, one, the stewards have to have the opportunity to function in isolation. Mm-hmm. And I'll put you on blast a little bit here because you made that great comment about the NBA referees. Clearly, and I'm just joking here, but clearly you've never watched an NBA game because 90% of an NBA broadcast is LeBron, Kyle Lowry, Chris Paul aggressively lobbying the referees. And again, I'm a fan of all of those players. I wish they didn't do it, and I don't like to see it, but this is a very close proximity to that, which is, in this case, Toto Wolff went to the steward's office, opened the door, and started lobbying them in real time. Yeah. This is like compromising a crime scene. Like, they need the opportunity to effectively digest and process the evidence in front of them. Now, you made a great point as well, which is, ultimately, Michael Massey sent him to the stewards, and I think the context here is pretty important, that I think he sent Toto to the stewards out of frustration, because we joke so much about the fact that Toto was hammering him with emails, probably sliding into his DMs, calling him on WhatsApp, Telegram, Viber, whatever means possible. He was trying to get his message through to Michael Massey. And I think Massey, in a flippant, frustrated way, says, "You know what? Damn it, Toto, just go see the stewards." And he probably regretted it the minute
probably,
he said, because of course, yeah. Toto, whoosh, straight to the stewards. Christian Horner hears, "Well, I need to be there to provide a balanced approach to this." Whoosh, he's in the office. I don't know why I'm making sound effects, but then he's in the office with the stewards. And the other complicated part of this too is that even post-race, when he was being challenged on this, Michael Massey said, "No, it's totally okay. They need to be able to have the conversation." And then he quickly backed.
Oh yeah, totally.
And I think the FIA, the stewards, Formula One, they realized that, hey, this isn't a good look. It's a really bad look if they're able to penetrate that steward's office. So hopefully, to your point, going forward, we're going to be able to allow those stewards to operate with full integrity. Because I think the worst thing that you would want is a scenario where a driver is clearly at fault, a team principal is able to get into the office, get in their ears, and there's no penalty. Because then all of a sudden, the entire integrity of the race is thrown into question because the team principals are so effectively able to lobby. So I totally agree with Christian Horner on this one. The other piece too is Michael Massey got a ton of negative press and criticism in terms of how he managed this race. And for those of you that don't know, he replaced Charlie. He was close friends with him unexpectedly because of Charlie's death in late 2018, 2019. Mm-hmm. Had to tell the Ram. He ran the 2019 season, 2020 hit. It was COVID. This year's COVID. Like, he's had a rough go of it himself, but he got some serious, serious bad press and some heat for the way that this race was ultimately handled. And it wasn't necessarily undue. I think he's ultimately in a tough position. But I do
agree
with Christian Horner.
But some of this stuff is common sense stuff, right? And I mean, totally, we've talked about it. We're talking about it now. And we talked about it, you know, after Austria. So, yeah, I mean, it is not an easy job, but certainly there's definite room for improvement. Let's put it that way.
I would just add one final thing. Is that if any good came out of this whole situation, mm-hmm. it is that eternally we have the Total Wolf email meme that will live on forever. And maybe all of this was worth it because we have a great new meme to share on Instagram, Twitter, and Reddit for the rest of time.
You know, just before we slide into a break here, Mark, you know, you're talking about like the whole thing, like the emails to Michael from Toto and the DMs and the WhatsApp. I would love to see like screenshots of like their WhatsApp conversations, like, dude, bro, what the fuck? You know, well, did you see that bleep? You know, I'd love to see. I don't think that Toto would necessarily stoop to the level of like
animated GIFs. You know,
that's right. I mean, I don't think I would hope that Toto's a little bit more mature. It is WhatsApp conversations that you and I are when we're messaging each other back and forth, but it would be kind of funny to see nonetheless. Anyways, let's try and drag this conversation up a notch or two, and we'll do so just on the other side of a quick break. So don't go away. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
All right, well, welcome back to the show. And, well, okay, we've only been talking about that incident for 35 minutes now. So what do you say we go? Got time for two more stories? No, I'm just kidding. I'm just messing with you guys. I wouldn't do that.
No, we need to get on to Valtteri Bottas speculation. We need to spend 20 minutes talking about where he's going
to
be.
You know, I hate to do this to you, my friend, but I have no Valtteri Bottas stories locked and loaded tonight. I apologize.
Do you at least have a George Russell story? That's
No, but I do have a Kimi Raikkonen story for you, but I don't have my Kimi book of haikus. So, I mean, I could go and grab it, but there are other things to talk about. You know, one of the things that I really enjoyed about last weekend, and unfortunately sort of kind of maybe got pushed to the side a little bit, was the whole concept of the sprint races. And I mean, we talked about it on Sunday, but it really became like an asterisk for the entire weekend. It became a little footnote, and we only really talked about it very briefly. But it's interesting, the McLaren team principal Andreas Seidel said that he's glad and he's happy that they did try out the sprint format at Silverstone, but he believes that the format should be reserved for specific circuits only. Now, I'm going to take that at face value, because obviously Andreas Seidel is obviously a little bit more experienced on trackside and in motorsport than I am. But for me, from, you know, this side of the screen, let's put it that way, looking at it from a fan's point of view, I'd say it's almost a little bit too early to tell. I mean, I don't think sprint racing would obviously, or the sprint format would work at, say, Monaco, for example. But I'm sure that, and I love the concept that you came up with the majors. You know, you pick 3-4 races a year, maybe USA, maybe Great Britain, maybe Japan, wherever it is, kind of spread them out so you have it one geographic region wherever the calendar is. But it's kind of interesting to hear that. But I really enjoyed the format. It made obviously for a very, very busy weekend of viewing, and just in general to schedule in. I mean, from a positive point of view, I mean, it was cool to be able to go on Friday night and sit down and watch the qualifying session, then have the sprint race on Saturday, and then have the Grand Prix on Sunday. My own take was I still liked the way that they had the qualifying on Friday. I would seed it everything for the sprint race. I thought that the sprint race being approximately one third full race distance, I think was about perfect. And you could tell after a while that they weren't going to push it too much further to save the machinery and maybe risk any incidents on track. And I think that's that they have to find that sort of sweet spot, because kind of give them the opportunity to try out there, go out there and do something on the track. But after a while, you know, they are going to try and protect the cars as well. But I think overall, I came away with a very positive view of the experience, and I'm eager to see it again. And Mons is going to be the next one up, so can't come soon enough.
Absolutely. And I totally agree with your comment a couple of moments ago about the fact that we probably didn't serve this experience with the coverage it deserved in our most recent podcast.
Yeah, it's like weird. You said, it's like really, something more noteworthy happened last weekend. Yeah.
And shame on us, because that was something I was actually really excited to talk about. Same. I was eager for your opinion. It didn't happen. So when I saw you built out the agenda and the outline for today's show, I was really excited to see that you tacked this one on. But I love the format. I'm not suggesting it's perfect. I've kind of flip-flopped back and forth in terms of ultimately, should pole be awarded for Friday? Should it be awarded for Saturday? Should more championship points be awarded on Saturday versus less? Like, I think there's still some opportunity to have a conversation, but as a concept, I love it. And I totally get it from a business perspective. And like I said before, I saw that tweet where somebody tweeted like, guys, don't you understand Formula is only doing this to sell more tickets and get more eyeballs on the TV. I'm like,
of course,
that's why the whole this point. Entire sport exists. Of course, that's what they're trying to do. And I'll be totally honest. I tuned in to Formula One live on Friday. If I watch free practice, I'm sure as hell not watching it live, and I'm probably watching a highlight package late Friday night before I go to bed. I'm not tuning in live. And the other thing I'll share, and you've been to a ton of Formula One races as well, nobody is at the track on Friday. Mm-hmm. Unless they buy the four-day pass and they're super devoted, there's nobody. It's a kind of a smattering of people within the grandstand. So for Silverstone to have 100,000 people there on Friday night, that's incremental ticket sales. That's gate revenue that they wouldn't otherwise have had. And we don't necessarily know what the global TV audience or the numbers were for Friday and Saturday, because the networks typically don't break those out. They typically just break out the Grand Prix on Sunday. I tuned into all of it, and I don't necessarily know that I would have. I tuned in live. And again, I'm always worried that I have coworkers and peers and superiors listen to the podcast. But on the Friday, I was also excited that the qualifying session was Friday night in the UK, which meant that it was the morning our time. So I was actually able to watch at least Q3 live. In fact, I actually had a meeting and shared my screen with my coworkers as I devilishly grinned on this podcast. But they thoroughly enjoyed watching Q3 with me. So I love the format. It's not perfect. I hope they continue to refine it. I also really do love the idea that this event, this format, should be reserved for some of your premium tracks, your premium events. Yeah. Silverstone, it's a perfect fit. Monza, it's a perfect fit. I would suggest COTA would be a great fit as well. Now, I had somebody slide me a DM earlier today, and they'd asked very specifically that their name not be mentioned on air. They're indicating that it will absolutely be either COTA or Abu Dhabi that is going to feature the next sprint qualifying weekend. So I would presume it's probably going to be COTA, but the reason they're suggesting possibly Abu Dhabi is because if the championship is close, they kind of want to create a super compelling mega weekend to kind of close the season. But my sense at this point is it's probably going to be COTA, and I'm totally cool with that because I think it's a great track that will really function well for this format. But yeah, totally. I love the weekend. Yeah. Not perfect. I'm excited to see how it continues to evolve.
Well, you know, I have to admit that I went into the weekend, I wouldn't say with a little bit of skepticism. I'd say it was a little bit of trepidation, a little bit of reservation, just because of that really botched up attempt to try and change the qualifying format
right.
4 or 5 years ago, whenever it was, and they abandoned it after only two or three races and went back to the traditional
final stand.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, we don't really need to rehash it, but it was a miserable failure. So I was a little bit more positive about this, but I was guarded in my expectations because it's one thing to come up with these plans and then see how it comes off in reality. But I think it went pretty good. So I'm looking forward to see it again at Monza, you know, several weeks from now. And then, yeah, I mean, I think it's a good call to maybe just hold out for the time being and see how the championship develops and then decide to do either at COTA or at Abu Dhabi. And I don't know, but I mean, if they were to skip COTA and do it at Abu Dhabi because the championship is too close, I understand it would be kind of a mega weekend, but is it almost too much of a good thing? I don't know, but it is awesome. I mean, I totally agree. I think the Circuit of the Americas is a great venue. I think it would be a fantastic track to have a sprint qualifying on. So I definitely see the logic and the desire to do it there. All right. I'm just pulling up something. So the Formula One this week, actually today, earlier today, has they just confirmed that Monza is going to be the next sprint qualifying.
Sorry, I may have blown that.
No, it's all good. Myself. No, but I mean, they've just released the schedule. So, I mean, they've basically come out to what's going to happen. So we're going to have an 18-lap sprint race, and it's going to start at 4:30 p.m. on Saturday. They expect it to run about 30 minutes, so it'll be done by about 5 p.m. local time. And then Sunday's Grand Prix is going to go with 3 p.m. Local time. So it's kind of cool. I kind of really like that late afternoon, the timing that they had at Silverstone. I don't know why. It just worked really well.
I loved it. One of the other thoughts I had, and I don't know if I've shared this before, one of the other things that I think really works well with sprint qualifying is it's a really tight, concise, digestible package. You're talking about an event that's less than 30 minutes. It's basically the length of a sitcom. And if you're talking about packaging up Formula One in a way that's consumable and accessible to younger fans that maybe don't have a long kind of patient sense of attention, I think it's a really great way to bring in fans. And it's something that I'm also, again, excited to see. And I'll be honest, I've been watching Formula One like you for 30 plus years, spent years watching it from the UK and the heart of motorsports country. I'll be honest, there's some times when I struggle to get through an hour 30, an hour 40 of a Grand Prix, especially if the outcome is predetermined by the lap 10 mark. Like, I struggle with that sometimes. I just think a 20 or 30 minute sprint qualifying event is so short, so concise, and so unpredictable. It's must-see TV. So again, I like the format, but I'm also super pumped. And I think we knew this was going to happen, so it's not a surprise, but I'm excited for Italian fans. I'm excited that the next sprint qualifying weekend is going to be at a track as phenomenal as Monza. It's an ultra high speed track. I don't know yet. And for anyone that's in Italy right now, you know who you are. If you could drop us a DM and let us know how we're looking from a spectator perspective, it was great to have fans at Silverstone. The only track potentially on the calendar that is better served by having a big crowd is Monza. And I think you would remember 2019 to see Charles Leclerc
that was awesome
for Ferrari at this track. One of the greatest moments in the last 4 or 5 years. And I would love to
absolutely.
See fans
I mean,
there once
it
again.
Was. And then also last year as well, Imola at Mugello, you know, we had three races in Italy. I mean, we had a handful of fans that, you know, absolutely.
Deserved,
so, I mean, I'm just taking a look at the schedule now. So, 1st of August next weekend, we have the Hungarian Grand Prix coming up. And then 29th of August is Spa after the summer break. Then we go to the Dutch Grand Prix beginning of September, Labor Day weekend. And then it's not till the weekend of the 12th of September is when we get to Italy. So it's a little ways out there. But I think that certainly it's really whetted my appetite for more of that. And hopefully we'll see people in attendance there because that is just one of those fantastic Grand Prix, especially if Ferrari's doing well. And that's something that still kind of blew my mind that they were so competitive last weekend. And well, that's a different discussion. But hey, let's take a quick break here and we'll come back. And then I want to talk a little bit about Danny Ricciardo. So we'll do that on the flip side. So don't go away. We'll be right back. All right. Well, welcome back to the show, everybody. And we've actually burned through a lot of these stories a lot quicker than I had expected, which is all good, which is great because we got some good messages and some emails to discuss as well. Now, Danny Ricciardo. Now, this is a guy I feel particularly bad for. I'm not surprised to hear him say that he's beyond the past point of frustration with the struggles, with the problems he's had at McLaren this year. And he's just said that he's finally accepted that it's a part of life and it's just going to be an ongoing challenge going forward. And it's frustrating. I think that is the perfect word that he's used, because I think we've seen most guys that have switched teams settle in and kind of find the sweet spot. I mean, Fernando's doing well at Alpine. Even Seb seems to have found a nice point or a good place to be at Aston Martin. Carlos Sainz has been pretty good for Ferrari, and you know, you can keep going on and on about some of these other drivers. But Ricciardo, I mean, considering how long he's been in Formula One, considering the record that he has, that I'm still surprised that he's just hasn't been able to figure it out. Anyways, Danny Ric had to say the following. And that was, quote, "It is still definitely at times frustrating, but I'm probably past the point of being frustrated. I think now it's kind of a reality that I'm still needing to find some more and just be at one with the car. That's probably the best way to put it. So I guess it's not going to be anything new for me now. I know I'm aware that it's probably going to be a process. I didn't panic at the beginning, but I was aware that I was losing ground. And I was just trying to understand where I'm losing and what it is that I need to help me get to know where, you know, there's 3 or 4 tenths a lap more," end quote.
Yeah, I would say I'm not particularly concerned about Ricciardo. I think folks in the media, I think analysts, folks, fans, followers on Twitter are excited to talk about this, that it's the end of Ricciardo. McLaren needs to do something. McLaren needs to make a change. Ultimately, Ricciardo's tossed into a tough position, and we talked about this. He spent 2 years with Renault. That never seemed to be a marriage that it was destined to last a long time. Not because there was necessarily any bad blood or a poor sentiment between him and the team, but I don't think that's necessarily where he wanted to be. And he being at Renault was really just a byproduct of the breakdown
for sure.
of his relationship with Red Bull. I think ultimately he left on a high note. He scored a couple of podiums at the back end of that run with Renault. Those plus the podium that Ocon scored were the first that Renault had enjoyed since they returned to Formula One in 2015. So I think he left on a high note. Comes into the McLaren situation. It's a new chassis, new car, new aero philosophy. It's also a car that's being paired with an engine that was never designed for that car or vice versa. And then he's also put in a situation where he's racing next to a teammate, Lando, who's developing this surge of popularity both in the US and in the UK globally, and is also performing very well. But he's also much more familiar with that car because he was so instrumental in the development of said car. Now, I think a lot of people are pointing to last weekend and saying, look, Ricciardo scored fifth. He had a great points finish. He was one spot behind Lando Norris. But when you look closer, the truth is in the pudding. Now, I don't know that that's an expression. But what I mean by that is he finishes 42 seconds off of Hamilton, but he's still 14 seconds behind Lando. So again, great job. He's deep in the points. Probably a big confidence builder for him. I think he's going to improve. I think the challenge, though, when you hinted on this a couple of minutes ago, and this is some comments that Daniel Ricciardo made during the Monaco race weekend, is he was frustrated because Lando is sharing telemetry data with him, which, by the way, isn't necessarily always the case. Drivers will not necessarily always share telemetry and data with their teammate. Now, it's typically more common than not, but if you look back to 2016, Nico and Lewis definitely weren't sharing data. But anyways, he was looking at Lando's data because he couldn't understand how Lando was putting so much time between the two of them lap over lap. And what he was finding was, one, Lando was braking much, 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 much later in a corner. And on top of that was carrying much more speed through the corner. And that could be, one, that Lando's car was better dialed in for his driving style. It could be that Lando was more comfortable with the car. It could be that he was just more familiar with the aero setup. But while Ricciardo started closing some of that gap, there's still a lot there. Now, that said, Ricciardo didn't forget how to drive a Formula One car in the offseason. He's going to get there. I have no doubt about it. Now, the other comment I have to add here, and I promise I'll move on real quick, is during the post-race session on Sky TV, Will Buxton and Alex Albon were interviewing Fernando Alonso. And they were talking to Fernando about his recent performance improvements, his recent performance gains, the fact that his form looks so much better. He's much more confident on track. And one of the comments that he made that really struck with me is that, you know, through the first four or five or six races of the season, he was driving based on input and feedback that the team were giving him. He came in there, he wasn't familiar with the gearbox, the power unit, the aero design, or the chassis. So he was driving the car based on what he was being told to do by the team. And he said it got to a certain point where he's like, you know what? Enough's enough. I am now going to drive this car based on my experience and my feel. And he said that as soon as he did that, his form improved. He's like, you know what? I trust myself. I can feel the car. I know what I'm doing. I don't need to listen to this input. And my point being that Daniel's probably in a tough position where he's getting feedback from the mechanics. He's getting feedback from the engineers. The aerodynamics are coming to him. He's looking at Lando's telemetry. He's probably getting feedback and input from 100 different sources. And I think he might just be getting a little bit overloaded and a little bit frustrated, which is why recently he did comment that, look, I just need to step away. And I think the summer break will be really good for him, especially if he can put in a good performance at Hungary, because at least he can go into the break saying, hey, a couple of really strong points finishes. I'm building on that. I've got a good
Yeah, you know, that's great. It's awesome when you get comments like that from a driver. And it's kind of funny that a driver that, I mean, love him or hate him. I mean, Fernando obviously has a ton of experience driving a racing car. So I find that a very interesting admission that he was getting. I mean, you would expect that he'd be getting a lot of feedback from the team initially, just based on the fact that it's a new team and he's been out of the sport for a little while. But it is interesting that he got to the point where it's just like, you know, instinct sort of just takes over. And it's just like, you know what,
exactly.
I should be able to figure this out on my own. And then if I need some feedback, I should be able to get it from the team rather than the other way around. I mean, that's, you know, really, really fascinating.
Absolutely.
Cool. Totally okay, so great. The next one is kind of interesting. This is from Kimi Räikkönen, who's urged the Alpha Formula One team to wake up and find more performance from their C41. So anyways, Kimi had to say, quote, maybe we need to make the car fast. It's simple. It's impossible to fight against them. And this is, against the other teams, obviously. Same this, same that, and try to fight with the other cars. Come on, we've got to wake up and do something, end quote. So kind of a typical Kimi quotes, sort of not really a lot of in it, but you know, you can tell that there's a bit of, I don't think it's maybe urgency, but it seems like a bit of frustration and a bit of what do you want to call it? Well, obviously he's trying to motivate them, but you can tell that he's not 100% happy. He's trying to really get them to wake up and smell the coffee, to try and do something to get this car to go faster and perform better.
It's funny that you bring this story up, because this is a hot button issue with the Spaces group historically. Not so much his performance this year, because I'm not necessarily sure that people were expecting a whole lot out of Alfa Romeo, although potentially Alfa Romeo could be one of those teams that benefits from the changes to the technical regulations going into 2022. But my assumption was that they were better last year than they were this year. My comment instinctively was going to be like, look, their performance has actually weakened. But if you actually look back at their performance last year, you know what, Kimi Räikkönen, he's been in the points once this year with a 10th place finish. He didn't get into the points last year until the ninth race, when he scored a ninth place finish. He had 2 ninth place finishes last year. He was only in the points twice. He finished with 4 points overall. Giovinazzi had 2 10th place finishes, a ninth place finish. He scored 4 points. So really, from a trajectory perspective, they're relatively on par. They're basically performing the same way they did last year, which is a little bit disappointing. Now, last year, obviously, they were saddled with that problematic Ferrari power unit. And by problematic, I mean, obviously, they were suffering in the same way that Ferrari was, because they were rocking the same Ferrari power unit in 2019. So the penalty applied to Ferrari was equally as problematic and challenging for them. But ultimately, they've made zero strides forward this year. Now, I know they're not providing any more upgrades to this car, and whatever upgrades they brought this year were pretty limited. But I kind of get it from his perspective that they're seemingly just treading water, and you don't seem to hear a lot from that organization in terms of ambitions. And ultimately, it could be that they're in very much the same position as Haas, and they just haven't openly acknowledged that, hey, look, this year's a write-off. It is what it is. We're not going to score a ton of points. We're not going to cash in on a bunch of championship money. We're putting all of our resources towards 2022. And Haas was criticized a little bit for that earlier this year when they made that admission that, hey, we're not going to invest in this car. We're all in on 2022. Our resources are limited. And as much as Alfa Romeo has this big glamorous banner attached to it, it has some backing from Ferrari, it's still ultimately run by the Sauber Motorsports Group, which isn't exactly a rich, resource lavished organization to begin with. But I would agree that I'm a little bit disappointed with their performance this year, just in the sense that they've developed the car in no meaningful
way.
Now,
maybe you can disabuse me of this point of view, or maybe you want to agree with me, but do you think that perhaps that my expectations of Alfa Romeo have maybe been inflated a little bit more than they should be based on the success that Charles Leclerc had with them in his rookie season before he was snapped up by Ferrari? Because let's be honest, he was doing things with the C38 or whatever that car was that he probably should not have been doing. I mean, he's just obviously a phenomenal driver. And I think that has maybe colored my expectations of what was Sauber Alfa Romeo then and now is Alfa Romeo Racing. I think that it's maybe unfairly biased my expectations of what I think that they should be doing.
I've never made that consideration. And I was lucky enough that I could actually see Charles drive live for Sauber. And back in 2018, it was still Alfa Romeo Sauber before they kind of more deeply entrenched that Alfa Romeo branding. But I actually did see him race for Alfa Romeo. And you're absolutely right. Like, if you look at his performance that season, he finished 13th in the championship. He had 1, 2, 5, 6, 7. He had 10 points finishes, finished the championship with 39 points. And I think at that time, you're like, hey, that seems like it's a good performance for a rookie. But in the context of what we're seeing out of Kimi and Giovinazzi right now, that may have been a Herculean performance, ultimately, that he was able to drag, like you said, that C38 to those types of points finishes. And maybe we didn't give him enough credit for what he was doing with that car. And maybe Ferrari did see that, which is why they were so quick to bring him up to.
Well, did he not also stick that car in Q3 a couple of times as well? I mean, the delta between. The delta between himself and his teammate then, Marcus Ericsson, who's doing pretty good in IndyCar now, is it was night and day. I mean, they were in completely different leagues. But yeah, it was funny. I'd never actually made the connection, but as you were talking, it just sort of all of a sudden popped into my mind.
And just for context as well, because that was a great point with Marcus Ericsson. That season he had 5, 6 points finishes. He finished with 9 points to Charles Leclerc's 39. And again, Charles Leclerc being a rookie in Formula One, not familiar with the tires, the grips, or most of the track. So a pretty phenomenal finish and clearly warranted that move.
So now this is another thing that you may have to correct me on here, because unfortunately I don't follow every twist and turn of Marcus Ericsson's motor racing career, but was that his last season or did he stick one more year in Formula One before he moved?
Yeah, so he started 14 with Caterham, 15, 16, 17 with Sauber. In 18, the team began its transition to Alfa Romeo Sauber. And 2018 was absolutely his last season when he finished 17th in the championship with, like I said, 9 points. And then to your earlier point, or to your previous point, jumped in 2019 over to Arrow Schmidt in Indy and then spent the last...
Gosh, you know, that's actually gone pretty quick, because now that I think about it and kind of go back over the past couple of seasons, but... Time, as they say, marches on. And on that note, time for another break. And when we come back, let's jump into the mailbag. We got some great messages, some great emails this week. So we'll do that in just a moment. So don't go away. We'll be right back in just
a
moment.
Sounds great.
Okay, well, welcome back to the show. So where do you want to start? Do you want to go to the DMs first? Do you want to go to the emails? I got that really good message that we have from Evan, and I think this is one both you and I are fairly eager to discuss. Shall we start there and then move on?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure, go ahead.
So I'll read this one. So this one came from Evan, one of our many amazing Twitter, and I don't like to say followers. I prefer to think of us as a community. I think sometimes follower is a bit of a disservice, because I like to think we're really collaborative and interactive, which is why we do the spaces sessions. But anyways, Evan says, Hey guys, I had a question. I'm not sure if you'd like to answer this on the pod or not, but like I said, I'm new to F1. So the first thing I decided to do, I'd feel out a driver or team that I felt most connected to, which by the way is a really great point, because if you're new to the sport, finding that alliance or that loyalty can be a unique journey. But anyways, upon reading about and listening to you guys talk about the drivers on the grid, I have decided that Pierre Gasly really stuck out to me. I always like to root for the underdog, and him being demoted by Red Bull, in which I feel was an overreaction to a young driver on the grid with a big team, I feel that he was much more suited for the seat than Albon, which was clearly shown by Albon struggling even more than Pierre did. So I guess my question is this. Pierre fought his way back to a seat in F1. He won in Monza, given he needed a lot to go right and barely held on. But where does he go from here? He seems to have a ton of talent. Does he get a seat with a team that can put him in a position to win a driver's championship in the future? And if so, who does it happen with?
And that is
so over.
This is an amazing one. As soon as you sent me this this afternoon, I was like, oh, I can't wait to talk about this, because I think this is a brilliant summation of the whole Pierre Gasly situation, right? And totally, I mean, I think that they pulled the pin on him a little bit too quick. I mean, he struggled going into winter testing. He had an accident in Barcelona, and they had, I think they ended up having to sacrifice a bunch of parts that were meant for Max's car, and it seriously affected their running and winter testing that year. And he just never really got into a groove with the big Red Bull team. So it, unfortunately, the writing on the wall was there, that it seemed that it was almost inevitable that they were going to pull the plug at some point and boot him back down. And unfortunately, they are those guys now. They have that reputation, and they've done it a couple of times. They've done it to Kvyat, they've done it to Gasly, they've done it to Albon. So, I mean, anybody coming into that team to take a seat whose name isn't Max Verstappen is probably going to have one eye, you know, looking, you know, or, you know, looking over their shoulder, right? But I think that, you know, I think what Evan says here, he says, I always like to root for the underdog, and him being demoted by Red Bull, in which I feel was an overreaction to a young driver on the grid with a big team. And I totally agree with that. I think that he's just completely nailed it. Now, I think that's a very, very good take on the situation. And I think that he's done exceptionally well. I mean, going back, you know, arguably a step down, which obviously it is, to Toro Rosso, who I think are kind of underdogs, because on their day they can surprise. I mean, sometimes I don't think they get the most out of their cars, because it, you know, tends to be a development team. So, I mean, we've seen flashes of the good and not quite so good with Yuki Tsunoda this year. I mean, when he's had his moments, he's been really good. And, you know, when he's been hot, he's been hot. And when he's not, he's not. So, I mean, that's, you know, what you're going to get with a young driver, especially in his first season in Formula One. But I think Pierre did the only thing he could do, was just maybe lick his wounds, go back, accept the situation, and instead of, you know, feeling sorry for himself, just make the most of the situation and really buckle down and do the best that you can. I mean, clearly there was obviously a bit of good fortune in the way that that the Italian Grand Prix shook out last year, and I mean, he really hung on by the, you know, by tooth and nail to that race victory. But I mean, the fact of the matter is, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that race gone two laps or five laps longer, he would not have won it. But the point is, it didn't, and he won that race, which I think is amazing. But now the million-dollar question is, and, you know, Evan's asking it, is like, he, you know, where does he go from here? I mean, I think he's really done a good job to reestablish himself in Formula One, but I really don't see an out for him, unfortunately, at this moment. I mean, they seem pretty comfortable with Sergio Perez at Red Bull. Ferrari's obviously locked up with Carlos Sainz and Leclerc, and Mercedes is obviously a question mark, and that second seat of Valtteri Bottas, that almost seems to be earmarked for George Russell, just given the connection there. And, you know, honestly, right, the way that I see this one shaking out is, I think that his time will come, but I think he's going to have to be patient for some time yet, until he gets an opportunity with Red Bull or maybe an opportunity somewhere else. That's just the way that I see it.
Yeah, and to rewind this one, and I very much agree with everything that you're saying. For those of you that aren't super familiar with Pierre's backstory, he won the GP2 championship in 2016 with Prima, which is one of the absolute premier organizations in the lower formulas. He won four races that year, took the championship with 219 points, managed to put in a couple of rides with Toro Rosso towards the back end of 2017, raced the entire season in 2018 with that team. I think he had 5 or 6 points finishes, scored 29 points, which isn't terrible for a rookie on the Toro Rosso team, especially given the fact that that was the first year that they'd been rocking the Honda engine as Red Bull was making that migration. For those of you that don't know, they actually moved Toro Rosso over to the power unit, the Honda power unit, a year before they moved the Red Bull team because they wanted to get some familiarity with the engine and how it matted with their chassis. 2019, so he rocks... He spends the entire year 2018 with Toro Rosso. Like I said, 5 points finishes. 2019 gets promoted to Red Bull. So first race, he finishes 11th. He puts in a couple of points finishes. There's a retirement on Azerbaijan. Then he has 6 consecutive points finishes, including a 4th place finish at Silverstone. Finishes 14th in Germany, and then he finishes 6th in Hungary going into the summer break. Now, this is where it gets a little bit spicy because as he's since said, and it has been quoted, going into the summer break, he was promised both by Christian Horner and Helmut Marko that his race seat was safe. And again, in reflection, looking back, that's not a bad first half of a year with Red Bull when it's a new car, it's a new power unit, it's a new engineer, it's new aero design. It's not a bad start, but they pulled the plug super early. It created all that chaos. He gets demoted to Toro Rosso. Alex Albon gets brought up. Alex Albon is clearly not ready. And again, all of this to me is a reflection of Helmut Marko's inability to effectively manage the driver academy. So it's great. You identified Gasly as a talent. You identified Albon as a talent, Max as a talent, Daniel Ricciardo as a talent. But with the exception of Max Verstappen, you've never been able to nurture them into a position where they're in a meaningful championship battle. So shame on Helmut, shame on Christian Horner. But ultimately, I agree. I think he should have had the opportunity to ride out the rest of that season. It would have eliminated all of the chaos and noise and friction that came throughout 2020 as we all sat here debating how long Alex Albon was going to be able to keep that seat. But to your point, I don't know where that clear next step is for him. I'd love to see him get a premier seat somewhere. I don't know where that's going to be. And I also don't know that it's necessarily the right move for him to go back to Red Bull because I don't feel that's a team that's great at nurturing drivers. I would hate to see him go there and struggle in his first couple of races and the immense pressure that's going to come down. I don't trust that Christian Horner and Helmut Marko are going to be able to develop him further. I think the best thing for him is either to stay where he is, especially if Red Bull are going to continue to invest in that team and try to make it a competitive outfit on its own, or potentially find a race seat somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's such a great question.
And I was just thinking too, one other thing now, and it's escaped my mind. It seemed brilliant at the time when I was thinking about it. Oh, I know what it was, is that it was the perfect opportunity for him to go to a team like Red Bull, but the timing, it didn't work because he was coming in to replace Danny Ricciardo, which was obviously plan B for them, because right up before the Hungarian Grand Prix in 2018, they were all saying that we're just literally dotting I's and crossing T's here on a new contract extension for Danny Ricciardo. And then out of nowhere, he drops this bomb right after the Hungarian Grand Prix, right in the first week of the summer break, saying, you know what, guys, I'm done. I'm going to Renault. And they really didn't have any other options. So he's got to go in and fill those shoes, which was always going to be a tough, tough ask of that. And unfortunately, I think that Ricciardo's legacy with Red Bull really, I think, tainted and really put Pierre Gasly under an enormous amount of pressure right from the get-go.
You know, that's such a great point and not something that I've really ever considered, that his promotion to Red Bull was a byproduct of the collapse in relationship between Christian Horner, Daniel Ricciardo, and Red Bull, right? Like, that was never anticipated. And we've talked about this before, where Daniel has since said in interviews that, look, I called Christian Horner and I said I was going to Renault, and he laughed because he didn't think it was serious. So I think after he informs Christian that he's gone, and this, of course, happened pretty late in the season in 2018, Christian's scrambling and they've got this kid in the academy. Mm-hmm. He's driving for Toro Rosso. He's probably not ready, but instinctively, this is also not an organization that signs drivers from other teams. They rely on their academy. He was the next guy up, and whether he was ready or not, he had to come in and fill that seat. And again, in retrospect, looking back at that year, I still don't believe the first half of the campaign was that bad. And I think it was a visceral gut reaction to pressure in the media. They weren't in a meaningful battle for
exactly.
the constructors anyways.
Great point. And I think that has been so overlooked. And I'm glad that you brought it up, because like, why pull the plug on a guy when you're not challenging for a driver's or constructor's championship? I mean, it was still clearly all Mercedes, and you weren't going to beat them anyway. So why do it then? And I mean, it's been a revolving door. I mean, finally, I think if you're a fan of Red Bull, that I think you have to have a little bit of, what is the perfect word? Well, let's just say you might be feeling a little bit more reassured that Sergio has seemed to really landed on his feet.
Good word.
And after maybe a bit of a bumpy start, he seems to have really settled in nicely. Okay, so which one next? Why don't we do Richard LeBlanc, because this kind of goes back, and his emails are always so nicely worded and thoughtfully phrased. So anyways, Richard has to say, "Hello, Mark and Mark. Thanks for your thorough and thoughtful parsing of the Hamilton-Verstappen incident at the recent British Grand Prix. I have settled down after a couple of tormented days of wringing hands and gnashing teeth over what I saw as an outrageous foul by Hamilton. After listening to your podcast and much reflection, I have to say I agree with Mark Daly that this was a racing incident. I still believe that Hamilton was mostly responsible for the crash. He did not intend to contact, but intentionally took a wide apex to force Verstappen as far to the outside as possible. Hamilton positioned his car knowing Verstappen would either have to back off or drive off the track. What he did is, when he did neither, the inevitable occurred. But to paraphrase Mr. Daly, this is racing. In fact, the episode of Cops demonstrated the very essence of racing, because car racing in these intense and frantic moments of wheel-to-wheel combat is aggressive, is violent, and potentially very, very dangerous. That is why we love it and are enthralled by it, and that is why we call it motorsport. The FIA has to balance how much they want to interfere with the drivers' will to race in order to keep the sport safe. As we saw in Austria, too much interference dulls the spectacle. However, as we can see from this highly entertaining debate, the regulators actually define what F1 is, and in this case, I think they nearly struck the correct balance." Very good. Yeah, I have nothing to add to that, but I just had to work in an email that had wringing of hands and gnashing of teeth. But I think it's a good email.
So it was a tremendous email, exceptionally well articulated. Obviously, he lavishes praise on you and your commentary. But I would also just like to add that we got a lot of emails and DMs over the last couple of days that started very similar to that. Like, guys, great, big fans of the podcast. Love everything you're doing. Great insight breaking down the race, .. But you're idiots and you're totally wrong. And here's a really technical explanation as to why. And again, this is fun, right? It's like, it's okay sure. to have opinions and to not necessarily agree on everything. It's just, it was a shame that it became so visceral on the weekend, like we talked about off the top. But great email, amazingly articulate, super, super, super.
Yeah, and I totally love the, having like opposing opinions and perspectives, as long as everybody keeps it civil, which, for the most part, has been pretty good. I mean, our community rocks, so
totally
they're the best for this sort of things. Okay, so do we want to go to Diego's, or why don't we go to JJ in H-Town? We haven't heard from JJ in a while. JJ has to say, "Mark and Mark, can you guys elaborate more on the problems related to dirty air with F1 cars? Specifically, my question is, when racing behind another driver, do you want to follow closely to get in its slipstream, or should you be concerned about maintaining the air intake system of your own vehicle? Still loving the show as always. Thanks, JJ from Houston." So this is a kind of an interesting question from a couple of points of view, because are you asking this question in 2021 or are you looking ahead to 2022? But I guess the basics are going to be the same, and you're looking awfully thoughtful and ready to go. So, okay.
Oh, no, I'm not. I was It's one of those moments when you're in the class and you're like, don't, like, hopefully the teacher doesn't pick on me, and you're looking out the window and you're sharpening your pencil and all that other kind of stuff. But I would love to.
Sure. Well, I think that the way that these cars are structured and built to right now is they really kick off a lot of dirty air. So the biggest problem is that this air awake behind it, the disturbance, the turbulence, really makes it difficult for the car following to get closer or follow close to the car in front of them. And if they do get closer, right, then they're going to pay a price in that. Of course, your brakes are going to overheat. You're going to get a lot of hot, dirty air going into your, in through your own intakes, into the side pods, and into your engines. You're going to suffer. Right. Your tires are going to pay a price as well. And ultimately, the longer that you stay too close to the car in front of you, and that's why you see that these guys will back off. You'll see them get to really close for a number of a number of laps, and then sometimes you see them start to ease off, sometimes right, to a second and a half, 2 seconds, 2.5, 3 seconds, where they're close, but they're not too close. They're kind of in that Goldilocks zone, that they're still in contact with the car in front of them, but you know, they're not quite close enough to maybe make an overtake. Or, you know, the other thing is too, they're not really sacrificing their car too much. And that is the big reason why we're going to see this new formula starting next year. We've seen the radical mock-up that they released before the British Grand Prix last year with these very different looking front wings, the rear wings, the very almost redefined, very sleeker looking side pods, and just the bodywork in general that are really going to clean up the air around this car, that is going to make it easier for them to follow. But if you do get in the slipstream, you do get in the tow, especially going down some of these longer straights like in Azerbaijan, down Hangar Strait, any of the long straightaways that you can think of in Formula One, when you can get that tow, and then hopefully by the time you get to the end of the pits straight, and if you have DRS as well, that you're able to close that gap and then hopefully make a move to dive into the corner and get around your opponent in front. So I don't know if you've got anything to add to that, but that's a great one, because there is a lot more to do with this discussion. And to do so, we've actually, this is a bit of a teaser to one of our shows coming up in the next couple of weeks that we're going to have over the summer break. And I'm not going to give away the guest or the topics, but we've already recorded the show, and it's going to drop in a couple of weeks. And we talk about this at length. So, you know, look out for that one, JJ and everybody else, because that's going to be a really, really good discussion.
Question. Yeah, again, F1 2022 primer episode will drop this summer. It's in the books. It's fantastic. It really takes this question and looks at it in much greater detail. But I think in the meantime, you did a
cool,
great job addressing.
Okay, so the next one, last, definitely not least, comes from Diego. And Diego has to say, hello, Mark and Mark. While I know that the subject to this email is clickbait, just hear or read me out. It wasn't clickbait, Diego. Always love it. Anyways.
Okay, we'll try. Anyways, we'll try.
Says, I'm a machinist that works for Roush. A coworker of mine was the one that introduced me to DTS, him being a fan of F1 since the 90s at least. F1 has now become one of my favorite sports. Anyways, these last few days, I can't help but think that maybe there is a way for Roush as a brand to join F1. We already have a NASCAR team, sure, maybe co-owned, but that's where my idea comes in. Maybe a partnership with Haas. Haas is in a lot of need of a lot of resources and money and whatnot. This partnership can help Roush as a branding globally. We already have our own version of Mustangs. A great relationship with Ford doesn't hurt either. Formula One is only going to grow bigger in the States. I guess the point of this email is to maybe hear your thoughts, since you guys are way more knowledgeable of what some logistics may be. I'm seriously considering making a PowerPoint to see if I can show it to our manufacturing manager and see if it goes up the ladder. Anyways, thanks for the awesome content you guys create and for being the home of Gen DTS. P.S. Don't change the intro music. So cool. Awesome. Love this email. And I was really excited when I read this one, and I started thinking about it, and who knows what Gene Haas is thinking. I still think that he's kind of sort of just keeping the seat warm. He's writing the checks, doing what he needs to do. And excuse me. And if somebody comes along with a checkbook and offers to buy the team, that he'll just sell up and move on. But I couldn't help but think that maybe this is the kind of partnership that a team like Haas might be, or might need, because you know, like, and I'm not going to point the finger specifically at Ford or any other American car company manufacturer and put them on blast for any success or lack thereof in Formula One, past or present or future, or maybe any reluctance to join the sport, because that's not related to any one manufacturer, to any one time frame, or any one country. I mean, we've seen some that have been more successful than others, and others have kind of come in and come out. I mean, one manufacturer for me that is what was a big disappointment was BMW. I was really excited when they came into the sport, and I was really disappointed when they pulled out and left. But I couldn't help but thinking that maybe that a partnership for Haas or a team like it with somebody like Roush is exactly what it needs. Because, I mean, let's just face it, the knowledge, the ingenuity, the expertise, and just the people involved in the automotive industry in the United States is absolutely massive. And while I don't know how feasible it is for maybe a manufacturer to get involved, I think that this is something potentially very, very exciting. And I just can't help but think, just like Diego says in his email, that maybe there's really something here that people somewhere up the chain really need to take a look at to see, is this something worth doing?
I love the idea of Diego being in a position where he can put together a PowerPoint presentation and get it in front of some executives and just sell them like, hey guys, here's a potential business plan to get involved with Formula One. Talk about Formula One. The upward trajectory in the US is obviously very, very significant. Maybe a better fit for this organization, at least initially, is IndyCar, a spec racing series. But I think it's exciting to talk about what the ceiling potentially is for Formula One in the US. And we talk about the number of events. We're going to Miami. We've got a race in Austin that's becoming more and more successful by the year. We saw how quickly it sold out this year. We talk about the potential for a third race coming to the West Coast, going to the Northeast, whatever the case may be. But I think one of the things that we really need to see is a really successful US-based team. Haas has been an unmitigated disaster, whether it's their partnership with Mazepin and his oligarch father, whether it was the relationship with Rich Energy, whether it's been some of the on-track issues. This organization's been a mess. I think Gene Haas is probably greatly embarrassed by what's transpired. But at the same time, he's not also been investing in it the way you need to be successful in Formula One. And part of it could be that he said, hey, look, I came into the sport. I recognize that the sport's transitioning to a cost certainty era with the cost cap. I'm just going to ride it out until we get there. I'm just going to cost control as much as I can, regardless of what the impact is from a performance perspective, from a grid perspective, from a championship perspective. I'm just going to ride it out, get to the cost cap era, and hopefully things kind of work themselves out. Whether there's a partnership opportunity here or not, I don't know. My sense is Gene Haas is either all in or all out, that he's probably not looking for another U.S. partner. But that's not to say that Roush Fenway could potentially not put together a package and enter F1. And again, one of the principal reasons for the cost cap and all of the different changes that they're introducing in 2022 through the sporting and technical regulations is they want to introduce cost certainty to the sport to make it more attractive to new teams to come. Because you can't be in a position where year to year you have some teams with 1,200 full-time employees and some with 200 that are hemorrhaging cash because they're so uncompetitive on the track, they're not earning any championship money. Like they need to iron all of this out. And ultimately, for instance, if I was to invest in a major league sports team, I'm looking to the NFL, I'm looking to the NBA, because there's cost certainty, there's salary caps, there's all these kind of measures in place to ensure that I can be financially viable. Formula One's never had any of that. They've never had any of that. It's a shark world. I don't know if that's an expression. It's a shark eat dog world. Ultimately, if you're Mercedes, Red Bull, Ferrari, you're going to be successful. But if you're a Williams, or you're a Haas, it's going to be very, very, very difficult to turn around your fortunes because you can't tank your way to a top draft pick to become competitive again. Again, I think to get back to Diego's original point, I would love to see this organization, this company get involved. I don't know that they necessarily will. I believe they exited the NASCAR Xfinity series a little while ago. I'm not super familiar with where they're fielding teams right now. I know that historically they've always partnered really closely with Ford, which isn't necessarily a bad thing if you want to appeal to American fans. But then again, maybe there's something there, and maybe ultimately the way that Ford becomes a successful OEM in F1 once again is by partnering with one of these big American companies, because Ford's obviously a big brand in the US. It's been very successful with NASCAR. But yeah, I would love to see a successful American team, because like I said, Haas has been nothing in terms of what we expected. They haven't been developing American drivers. They haven't established an American driver academy. They're effectively driving a race car right now that's wearing a Russian flag. And I'm going to say it out loud. I think Haas has been an embarrassment. It has not been to F1 what F1 needed it to be. And fortunately, in spite of what Haas has done, Formula One's continued to make inroads in the US marketplace from a viewership perspective and from an interest perspective. But that's in spite of the things that Haas has or hasn't done. But again, would love to see a really
in spite of or despite
team.
Of, I don't know which way it goes, but
I don't know either. Actually, I think it's in spite, but I was going to use the two interchangeably.
Well, so I let my Canadian show when I said Roush rather than Roush, but you know, whatever, you know, Canadian is as Canadian does. Yeah. But I was just going to say I think it really is a, you know, that this sort of scenario, be it them or another organization, may be a way for the American automotive industry to really put a footprint on modern Formula One. Because let's face it, people are smart. Sports fans are smart. They've seen what Haas have done. I mean, they had a real... I think they really had a tantalizing start to Formula One. I think they got some people excited with some good early results, and then it quickly fizzled out. But I mean, people seeing, you know, all the silly things that have happened with, you know, like the whole Rich Energy thing, which I've never seen a can of Rich Energy drink anywhere, which is another story. But I think that this might be the way to do it, because people have seen what Haas have done and what they've been doing. And I think the synopsis is, whether they're a long-term Formula One fan or Gen DTS, I think a lot of people are just like, meh, not feeling it.
Exactly. Again, if you're going to use Haas as a marketing vehicle to attract new teams to F1, it's not going to work. 2016, despite, to your point, they scored a couple of points finishes early in the season. People were freaking out. Look, we need to change the regulations. You can't have a team come in and buy so many pieces from Ferrari. They're going to be too successful too soon. Ultimately, the performance flattened out and they finished eighth in the championship, finished eighth in 2017. Meg had shared, again, reminded us earlier this evening on the Spaces call, they had a pretty strong 2018 when they finished fifth in the championship, but ultimately their chassis fell apart and they collapsed in 19, 20, and 21's been a total disaster. But for F1, you need to be able to say to a potential new entrant that, hey, look, you could come in, there's cost certainty, you could become competitive, you can win, you can be successful. Because again, even with a cost cap of $145 million, if you're going to join the sport, there's a sunk cost of hundreds of millions of dollars to build a factory, to recruit people, to buy the machining, to create an engine relation, or to create a relationship with an engine supplier. Like, it's really expensive to enter Formula One, and nobody's going to do that unless they can see that there's cost certainty, that there's a pathway to being successful. And if you look at Haas, again, they entered at the wrong time, no cost cap, no cost certainty. But they're a terrible story for why you should come in and enter Formula One.
Hey, Mark, just before we wrap things up, Guitar Gill in the live chat in YouTube says, has anyone seen a can of Husky Chocolate? And they're a sponsor of a McLaren.
That's McLaren.
You know, I haven't. But I do remember looking it up online, and I can't remember where you could pick it up. And I almost want to say, I think I could have found it locally, but it was kind of... Let's say it was a little bit off the beaten track. That's a great point as well. Anyways, guys, thank you all for the emails and all the messages and stuff like that. I see that we're starting to kind of come to the end of the time that we're going to spend together tonight. So we've got a lot more. And because we don't have a race this weekend, we're going to hang on to the some of these other ones. We'll talk about them when we come back on Monday night. So let's wrap it up right there. And again, thank you all for downloading, listening to the show. Thank you for the messages. Thank you for watching on YouTube. Thank you for any reviews or ratings you might have left on Apple Podcasts or any of the other podcast platform. You guys are the best. We really appreciate it. Yes.
Follow us
of
on
course.
Twitter. Follow us on Twitter. Join the community.
Absolutely. @ScuderyF1Pod is the Twitter handle. Also, if you want to get in touch via email, you can
thanks so much, guys.
@ScuderyF1Pod@gmail.com. And that's it. On behalf of myself and Mr. Mark Hamilton, Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, and we will see you on Monday night. Bye for now.